Welcome to Amplify Your Process Safety, the podcast that provides the experience and expertise you need when it comes to process safety and risk management. Our hands-on approach will give you the insight needed, whether you're new to industry or process safety, in a role where you interact with aspects of process safety, or an experienced process safety professional. Join us in our mission to protect people, the companies they work for, and the communities where they operate by making process safety knowledge available to all.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. I'm Rob Bartlett, and with me is Molly Myers. Molly, what are we going to be talking about today?
So today's episode, we're going to be reviewing another incident investigation report issued by the Chemical Safety Board, the CSB. Okay. It was covering an incident at a KMCO, or Chemco, chemical facility that's located in Crosby, Texas. The incident occurred on April 2nd, 2019, and this was one of several reports that the CSB issued in December of 2023. So, Rob, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the background for the facility and what they were handling?
Okay, Molly. So the Chemco facility was built in the early 1970s, and in July of 2012, it was bought by a private equity firm. And they essentially, it was family owned up until it was bought by this private equity firm. I think it was called Chemco LP for a limited partnership. And then in 2012, bought by private equity, now it becomes Chemco LLC. And so this private equity firm bought them, and they invested over $50 million in improving the facility. They employed 164 people at the time of the incident, and they were manufacturing specialty chemicals and operating as a tolling facility, which means that they were making product, making chemicals for other companies. In June of 2016, the company announced a new leadership team to ensure the safe and compliant operation of the facility, and many new management personnel were hired so that they could improve the site's process safety management program. So they knew they had some process safety issues, right? Obviously.
And they were making a concerted effort with money and personnel to improve their process safety.
Yeah. And unfortunately,
it sounds like they made a lot of progress.
And as happens, they ran out of time. Yes. Something happened before they could get through the whole process. So just to kind of close out the corporate issues related to Chemco, they did actually file for bankruptcy after this incident in May of 2020, and the facility was sold to a new company called Altivia. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Altivia Oxide Chemicals, and Chemco as a business actually no longer exists. And interestingly, Altivia decided to demolish the unit that was involved in the incident. And I say interestingly because in the report, the CSB essentially didn't make any recommendations to the facility because they were going to be shutting down anyway. So that's why that fact is pertinent. So going back to what they were doing back for the incident, the facility handled isobutylene, which is a highly flammable colorless gas. It's among the gases that are commonly referred to as LPG, liquefied petroleum gas. It's typically transported and stored in a liquefied form, which is how Chemco handled it. It's used in the production of aviation fuels, resins, chemicals, packaging, plastics, and antioxidants for food. So obviously it goes into a bunch of stuff. And the specific unit here at Chemco was actually producing a lubrication additive using a batch process. And just another thought about isobutylene is it is highly flammable, and therefore it is required to follow OSHA's PSM standard because they had more than 10,000 pounds of it in place. And they also were covered by EPA's risk management program as a program level 3 process. So that's a little bit of background about the company and the facility and what they were handling. So Molly, on the day of the incident, what happened?
So the real root cause was that they had a Y strainer, just a basically piping component, a small strainer that was in the system, and a liquid isobutylene line that failed. and it resulted in a loss of containment. In other words, the isobutylene was no longer contained in their piping system and was released. The isobutylene quickly vaporized as the pressure was reduced to ambient, and it formed a vapor cloud. And it created quite the cloud. I think there was a comment from a supervisor that had noticed basically a 2-foot wide river running down the street of this gas from the facility. So that was basically what happened. There was a field operator who was really a trainee, very new to the unit, and a contract worker in the area that heard and saw the failure happen. They both quickly left the area. Since the field operator wasn't sure what to do or what was coming out, what was going on, he asked the board operator, who was a more senior person, to come out and help assess the situation. So that operator immediately realized the significance of the event and used their radio all-call feature to call for an evacuation of the unit. And then that operator put on a self-contained breathing apparatus, SCBA, and went back out into the unit to manually close an isolation valve so that they could halt the release. We'll get into it in a minute, but they didn't have a way to stop that flow of material remotely. So the operator was closing valves. There was another operator that also came out to assist, and they were turning on fire water monitors, instructing personnel to shut down motorized equipment, keeping people from driving into the area. That's when a shift supervisor also heard that all-call notice on the radio and headed towards the facility. That's when he saw that this river of flammable gas was leaving the unit and going all the way down the road. And so he realized that this extended far beyond the boundaries of the unit. And so he went on the radio and ordered a plant evacuation. Then he went into a nearby building to manually shut down a boiler and was turning on additional fire water monitors. Unfortunately, that vapor cloud that was progressing its way down the road found a source of ignition before the operators and the supervisor could finish what they were doing to address the situation and evacuate the area. The explosion happened about 10 minutes after that initial failure of the strainer, and one of the operators that was in the unit trying to address the situation was killed, and the other operator and the supervisor that were also in the unit were severely burned. There were other personnel who suffered injuries, but those were the three most significant injuries. The first member of Chemco's emergency response team had their gear on and were headed to the unit, but they weren't en route until 3 minutes after the explosion occurred, unfortunately. In addition to the injuries on site, there was a shelter-in-place order issued for the surrounding community for about 4 hours. There was one interesting thing that I noted in the report. As I said, that there was one operator trainee and a contractor that were right in the vicinity when that strainer failed and they saw what happened. The contract worker immediately realized the danger to themselves, and the report said that that person left the unit, made a beeline to the parking lot, hopped in a car, drove 3 miles away, and was just getting out of their car when they heard the explosion. So they made sure that they were in a safe location before they were making any phone calls to their supervisors and so forth. So that is definitely the right approach that should have been taken, is when you see a significant event like this, everybody should get themselves to safety.
Get out of Dodge.
What happened with that emergency response? That was a big issue.
Yeah. Well, before we get into that, we're going to be talking about electrical classification a little bit more, but I just thought before we leave kind of the facts of what happened, mm-hmm. You know, a river of vapor, 2 feet tall or whatever it was, a two foot river of vapor. They never found out what the ignition source was. And when we do our work, we find that a lot is that, well, we don't know exactly what the source was. which is why when we're doing PHAs and people say, oh, we're going to have a release of flammable material, but it's all an electrically rated area, so nothing will happen. Like, the electrically rated area will help you and hopefully mm-hmm. reduce that risk, but it doesn't eliminate that risk. It will find, given enough time and enough volume, yep. it will find an ignition source. And when it does, don't be around when it happens. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of emphasize that. Let's talk about what went wrong. So we've got it broken up in a few different areas, but first thing we're going to talk about is, as you said, Molly, the emergency response. So according to CSB's report, the emergency response plan was being revised and the updated version wasn't actually in effect at the time of the incident. However, as part of that update, there was an incident command training activity and tabletop exercise that was planned for April 5th. And those of you keeping score at home, that means that it was planned for 3 days after the incident happened.
Right.
So,
they were making a lot of improvements to their PSM program. Their emergency response plan was one of the things that was in progress.
Yeah. And they were actually going to be having a training exercise with the local fire department. The Crosby has a volunteer fire department. And yeah, so unfortunately that the event happened just a few days beforehand. No idea what would have happened if things would have been any different after that training activity, but that was unfortunate. Let's see, the next one, the Chemco facility, they had a plant alarm system to alert everybody on site to an emergency. However, no one actually activated it. Molly talked a lot about getting on the radio and all that sort of mm-hmm. stuff, which helps, but there was no actual alarm, which basically would have told people, get out. There's rally exactly. points, whatever, leave the facility and don't come back unless you are a trained hazmat response person. They relied on the plant radio system. However, not everybody on the site carried a radio. That's why we have alarms, because not everybody exactly. carries radios. Mm-hmm. And for each team of contractors, it was typical for only the foreman to carry a plant radio, and therefore not all personnel heard and responded to plant evacuation notice. And one thing, I've driven by this facility. We've got another client that is down in Crosby that I was at, I don't know, I guess a year or so ago. And I actually drove by this Chemco, no longer Chemco, but I drove by the facility, and it's a big facility. There's a lot of equipment there. And if you look at the CSB report and you look at the overhead shot, the overhead photo of the plant, there's a lot of congestion. There's a ton of vessels. There's a ton of storage tanks. So this is not a small facility. And so, you know, I kind of look at that. I'm like, wow, they are lucky. They are lucky. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really it's tragic that we lost someone in this incident. It's lucky that we didn't lose a lot more people the way this, where this was, what happened, et cetera. Right. So,
yeah, those plant-wide evacuation alarms are really critical. There was something in the report that talked about, one group of contractors, and the only reason that they were saved is that their foreman or supervisor happened to clue in that there was a problem. They saw the shimmering of the vapor cloud and understood what that might mean and headed everybody else out. But otherwise, the people in that group wouldn't have had a clue and would have continued on their way and perhaps gotten injured. So,
yeah. Okay, one last thing to say, and then we're going to talk about the failure itself. One of the plant gates that personnel rushed to for evacuation was locked.
Yeah, not
so
good.
The workers there forcibly lifted the gate to allow people to crawl underneath to get out of the plant. So that's like, you know, I don't know, like lock and close your emergency doors, emergency mm-hmm. exits at the movie theater or something
right.
like that.
Right. It wasn't clear in the report if perhaps there was alternate exits that they should have been going to, but that was unfortunate that they all congregated in what they thought was an exit, only it wasn't a viable exit.
Well, this goes back to rally points and evacuation and practicing and all that. And mm-hmm. I don't know how they were, but obviously if they evacuated to a place that was locked and couldn't let them out, there certainly had to have been an issue there. Okay, Molly, right. Let's turn to the specifics of the incident itself. Why did the strainer fail?
Right. So, as I said, this strainer in the isobutylene line broke there's some pictures of it in the CSB report, but basically a chunk of metal on the side of the strainer just broke apart and fell off.
It was a good sized chunk too. We're not talking yes. a little bit. That was a big, I mean, that was a decent chunk.
Exactly. Yeah. So the main reason that failed was it was the wrong material construction. The strainer was a cast iron, which is a brittle material. And those types of materials tend to have catastrophic failures like this strainer at Kemco. The piping system was stainless steel, which is a ductile material, which tends to deform or provide some warnings before catastrophic failure, which is why the preference and recommendations are not to use any brittle materials like cast iron in any sort of hazardous service, such as flammable or toxic materials. But unfortunately, the strainer did not adhere to that. Also, the strainer was installed in a section of piping. They had a isobutylene circulation system from a storage tank that went out by the unit and then circulated back. And then the takeoff point from that circulation system into the process had the strainer and a check valve installed at that takeoff point to prevent backflow. And unfortunately, once the user inside the unit was shut down and they no longer needed isobutylene for that batch, they'd finished their charge step, they isolated that section of line. That was outdoors, and it was subjected to ambient heating over the course of the day, which caused the liquid that was trapped in that section of line between the check valve and the unit to expand from thermal expansion, thermal heating. And when you've got a liquid full system that gets heated up like that, there's no place for that liquid to expand to, and so the pressure spikes dramatically. And so the CSB determined that the cast iron strainer was subjected to this thermal expansion in the piping system, that increase in pressure, and that blew out the section of the strainer. There wasn't any pressure relief device installed in that section of piping to handle that thermal expansion and pressure rise.
So rather than crack and have a leak coming out of a crack, I mean, this mm-hmm. a whole section of it broke off. So I just want to like kind of paint that picture for folks. Right. If you think of, I mean, I know it's going the other way, but you know, I think of freezing water pipes, mm-hmm. right? Is they will kind of crack, break apart to cause a leak. But this one actually is a big chunk of it.
Big fracture. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of times, the other thing with this thermal expansion in a ductile piping system, stainless steel or something like that, that's like a flanged piping system, a lot of times what you'll see is a leak at a gasket or something like that, where it's a small release. The nature of that thermal expansion, it doesn't take much volume to be released from the system to keep that pressure right. down. It's right. just a few drips, really. Yeah. And yeah. so if it were a ductile system, it probably would have sprung a small leak at a gasket. You would have spilled a little bit, and then the pressure would have come back into range, and it might not have been as significant. But right. because
so
of the ductile nature.
So you might have had some sort of incident.
Yeah.
You might have had some sort of incident. You might have even had a fire. You might have mm-hmm. had some sort of explosion, but you wouldn't have had rivers of isobutylene flowing down the road.
Exactly. Yep. And so the one other piece about the strainer that was interesting in the report was back on the design of when this system was installed. The design originally had that isobutylene piping in carbon steel, and they were anticipating significant problems with rust and sediment, and they had designed a big bag filter and thought they needed to handle a lot of filtration. But they ended up changing the piping system to stainless steel, so that whole rust and sediment formation concern went away. And there was kind of confusion as to why did they even have the strainer? There was comments that they've never had to pull anything out of it. They never cleaned it. They didn't really use it. And it seemed like that was a design oversight.
Service in a, It should, I mean, clean service in a non-corrosive environment shouldn't need that sort of a strainer in it.
Right. And so this strainer was kind of an overlooked piece of the design. Doesn't seem like it really got considered in terms of the piping design. Somebody just saw a strainer marked on there and said, oh, gosh, I guess we need one of those. And here's something in the storeroom. Let's just grab that and stick it in place without realizing that it didn't meet the piping specification. It didn't match the criteria for stainless piping. Yeah. So that was very unfortunate.
Managing change, huh?
Exactly. Yep. And so that's kind of the gist of the strainer and what started the problem.
What kept it going?
We talked a little bit about the emergency response, but let's talk some more about what they could have done to stop or limit the release.
So we've got a release. We've got a failed component in our system. We are now releasing a highly flammable material. Well, let's stop the flow. Okay. Unfortunately.
Yep.
There were valves, isolation valves, upstream and downstream of the strainer. The unfortunate thing is that they could only be activated in the field. So somebody, and Molly, when you were talking about what happened, our operator suited up in an SCBA and went out to try to actually actuate the valves. Now he did, or they did.
Right.
So they shut it off. But by that time, I got to go get my SCBA. I got to put my SCBA on. I got to get out to the field. I'm probably nervous. All that stuff, that's all that time is more material that's been leaking more chances for it to find ignition source.
Yeah, the report indicated that like over, I think, 10,000 pounds had been released by the time he finally got out there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, you know, not to think that Kemco is out there on their own with that. There have been several recent CSB reports that have focused on the fact that we had highly hazardous materials that did not have remotely activated shutoff valves. And the Philadelphia refinery fire, the Philadelphia Energy Solutions fire that happened in, I think, 2019, and the Intercontinental Terminals Company, and then also the TPC Group, all of those reports highlighted the fact that there was no ability to remotely shut off the flow of a hazardous material. And also, just to note, there are several RAGIGAP documents that cover the use of these, including API, CCPS, and also health and safety executive in the UK. Also to throw out there a couple of things. First off, insurance audits in 2010, 2017, and 2018 identified this need. Kemco apparently had installed these on 5 vessels by the time of the incident, but unfortunately they ran out of time. They didn't get to this particular unit. And, you know, and unfortunately, things like this require capital. They require engineering. Mm-hmm. They require time to implement. And if you have, looking over the facility, I've not seen, not like I've seen P&IDs for the facility, but it looks like there's a lot of different facilities here. So if you're going to do this, you got to do it a lot of times, which is very expensive and which is very time consuming. However, this is what you're risking. If you say, well, we're going to do this over the next 5 years, well, this is what you're risking for the 5 years. And then the other piece I'll throw out there before we talk about other contributing factors, the other piece is that in the report, the CSB specifically notes that the Center for Chemical Process Safety, the CCPS, has published a guideline for fire protection in chemical, petrochemical, and hydrocarbon processing facilities. And in that book, from what, Molly, I think you said that was the early 2000s or something like that.
2003, I think. But yeah. And it was also referenced and included in the report as well.
Yeah. So there actually is, there's a flow chart in there to assist in determining when a remote isolation valve should be installed. And as I said, that's included in the report. And essentially what it comes down to is if you have a corrosive or a toxic, mm-hmm. yes, you need of any amount, you should have a remote isolation valve. If you have, I think it was more than 2,000 pounds of flammables or combustibles.
Right. I think it was like 2,000 gallons of the flow.
But it was a more significant amount. More than a significant amount, then you really should be putting one in. So if you have facilities that don't have these remote isolation valves, please consider consulting that. You don't even have to buy the book. The decision tree, the flow chart, if you will, is in the CSB report. You can just look there. So, okay, that's a little bit about the isolation valve. Molly, what else should we be talking about for contributing factors?
Yeah, there were a few other things that the CSB report noted that we wanted to bring to your attention. as Rob mentioned, the electrical classification and the fact that this vapor cloud found an ignition source is not really surprising. But nope. The unfortunate piece is that there was an old control room, a former control room, they called it an R2 building, that was near the area. They had, as part of their capital improvements, they had built a better control room with proper protections for the personnel and all that sort of stuff. But this old building was still out there, and it contained unclassified electrical equipment, such as motor starters. And unfortunately, the building wasn't pressurized to prevent flammable vapor from entering the building, and it did not meet the Class 1 Division 2 electrical classification that was called for on their electrical classification plan.
Right.
And there was some outstanding recommendations from insurance reports dating all the way back to 2013, noting this, that they needed to either relocate that electrical equipment or some way, quote, harden it. Okay. Yeah. So that flammables couldn't reach that location. And as we keep saying, they had good intentions, they were making progress, but that was one item that had not been addressed by the time of this incident.
It sounds as though, you know, they had been working on their process, their PSM program, and maybe the changes, you know, maybe they didn't have a management of change process like when they built the new control room, which the CSB report said. But, you know, this whole idea of putting non-rated equipment in an area that's rated as electrically classified, whether it's Class 1, Division 2, Class 1, Class 2, doesn't matter. If it is electrically rated and we're doing our management of change process properly, we should be catching the fact that, oh, that motor needs to be Class 1, Division 2, Group D, or right, Group E, you know, whatever it's going to be. And that should be brought up in your MOC process. So anyway, not to get on my soapbox too much here, but we do see this all the time. We see, right, like, wait a minute, you've got a flammable material there and you've got a normal 110 outlet 2 feet away from it. Mm-hmm. Obviously that's not acceptable. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. So also wanted to mention that because they were covered by PSM and RMP, they were required to do audits every 3 years. And their audit just prior to the incident happened in January 2017. The audit reviewed all of their PSM programs as it's supposed to do, and they found numerous weaknesses. In fact, the CSB report noted that out of all of the various questions on the audit protocol, there were recommendations associated with 92% of those questions.
I've been to some, let's just say, less than stellar facilities before. I have never had a recommendation rate or a finding rate that high before.
Right. And we didn't, the report doesn't go into the detail of the audit and the level of recommendations, but needless to say, there was a lot of gaps identified by that, and the management team was working diligently to address many of those. You could imagine they had their work cut out for them with that many recommendations.
Absolutely.
But unfortunately, they hadn't addressed a lot of those gaps, including the emergency response plan by the time the incident occurred. So, you know, robust PSM programs require all the elements to be fully developed and coordinated together. I mean, it's definitely a team effort. And so when a program like this at this facility is allowed to lapse, like this one apparently had, or was never developed correctly, it's going to take significant resources to bring it up to industry and regulatory expectations. So just be aware that having a good PSM program is a challenge. It takes a lot of effort and it's an ongoing process. And if you don't stay on top of it, it is easy to have it fall into disrepair in the course of that 3 years in between audits. And then you find yourself in a big problem like these folks were. So,
well, we've talked a couple times about how they ran out of time to improve their process. And this is a good example of how sometimes it sounds as though these people, the management, brought on some additional resources or maybe new resources that had more experience in how some materials processing. But if getting your PSM program either established or back up to where it's supposed to be is going to take you a long time with your existing resources. You really got to go out and get other resources. I mean, like us, exactly. Right? I mean, that's we do get calls like that. Like, hey, we need a PSM program. We don't have the internal resources. And I think that management is like, well, you know, we don't have the money for it or whatever. And I certainly, you know, I've not been on that side of the fence. I know what it's like. But at the end of the day, especially if you're a small sort of business, I mean, an incident like this is a business killer. And this is a perfect example of that. I mean, that business no longer exists anymore. Luckily, the assets are being redeployed in a different company. But yeah, it's if you need external resources, it's really not doing anybody any favors to save some money by taking longer to do it with your internal resources.
Right. And it was clear from reading the report that they were making an effort and had a lot of things in the works, but unfortunately, this incident happened before they were able to finish that list of their to-do list for PSM improvements.
With 92 findings from an audit, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, a couple other things that the report noted was that for some of the PHAs, the P&IDs were not accurate. There was one example of a PHA where this particular section of piping didn't show the check valve, the strainer, and the manual isolation valves that were present in the system. So when you have P&IDs that are incorrect, inaccurate, incomplete, it really makes it difficult to do a correct PHA, an adequate PHA. You can't identify the hazards if you don't know what the components of the system are. Also, the PSI, process safety information, didn't clarify that the strainer did not adhere to the piping specifications and material construction for the rest of the piping system. It didn't make a note that it was cast iron and not stainless steel. So when you have incomplete information, it's not surprising that your PHAs, your process hazard analyses, are going to miss things. So it's critically important that you have up-to-date and accurate information before you go into your PHA. And then lastly, they had some prior incidents with leaks on the strainer system. Unfortunately, their incident investigations didn't result in any significant changes or improvements to prevent similar future failures. So it's really important that you take those lessons to heart when you have, especially loss of containment incidents or near misses, if you want to call it that, where you had a leak but nothing bad happened. You really need to look into those and figure out what caused that loss of containment, what was the contributing factors, and what can you do to prevent something like that from happening again so that you don't have a major release like they suffered. So those were the main, you know, contributing factors the report mentioned.
So usually in our podcast here reviewing CSB reports, this is usually where we say, and the CSB made the following recommendations. However, we can't say that. And as I said earlier, because Kemco filed for bankruptcy after the incident, and that the new company was planning to demolish the unit, then they didn't have any recommendations. So
And a lot of times they'll have recommendations to other governing bodies or standards organizations, but in this case, there were references and there were design information and there were RAGAGAP, recognized and generally accepted good engineering practices that are applicable. They just hadn't been followed in this case, so that's why they didn't have anything to recommend, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, and often recommendations are made to NFPA or API, but everything already existed. And I think that that does point to something that I've run into a few times. And I would guess, because I don't think people make these sorts of mistakes on purpose, I would guess that whoever designed this or put this in, you know, the strainer in, designed the facility, whatever, they didn't know what they didn't know. And I've had this, I had a client one time. They were told that their stairs from one level to another level didn't meet code, state code for a stairwell. Okay, fine. So they went and they bought a set of stairs that you would assemble, that they assembled on site and put in. And then A year or so later, the building inspector happened to be on site for something, and they looked at those stairs and said, "What are those doing there?" "Oh, they were, you know, the engineer's all proud. Oh, we put those in." And I don't remember what the issue was, but it still didn't meet the code. So they had to take those out and actually put in, like, they basically just made a custom, they hired some guys to custom make a fab one for them. But my point is that they didn't know what they didn't know. They didn't know what the code was. Right. And this is why it is so vital, not just for strainers or piping components, but is so vital to have people doing your engineering that know what they're doing and that know what the requirements are and understand rag and gap. And if you don't know, go find somebody that does know. It doesn't mean all your engineers need to be experts on all of the codes, because nobody can be.
They're an awful lot of them.
They've got to know when they need to go to someone. There are things that I know pretty well that Molly comes to me to ask questions for. And whenever I've got a pressure release device calculation issue, I go to Molly because she's the expert on it. I am not. So I do want to throw that out there to folks. And I think we're getting a little long-winded here, so I apologize for that. But I think it is very important. Have a sense of what you don't know and make sure that you either check it out yourself or ask somebody that does know for some of these types of issues. And with that, I will get off my soapbox. And why don't we talk about, we've said that Kemco filed for bankruptcy. Okay, fine. But there are things that we can learn other companies can learn from this. And the CSB pointed some of those out. So Molly, why don't we go through those?
Yeah, so the first one is cast iron is a brittle material, and you really should not be using that in any form in a hazardous chemical service. If you're handling flammables or toxic materials, make sure you do not have any brittle components like cast iron fabrication. There are others out there, but in this case, it was cast iron.
Yeah. Okay. So that's number one. Number two, ensure that any liquid piping system that could be isolated and exposed to heating, and that can even be just ambient temperature rise, make sure it's protected from overpressure. This is often accomplished by using a pressure relief device. And as Molly said, they don't have to be big pressure relief devices because most of the time to overcome that thermal expansion temperature just needs a little bit of material to come out and be released somewhere safe.
Right. Yeah. Number three was ensure that the facility has an emergency notification system and that all the personnel are trained on how to use it in the event of an emergency. In this case, they had
a
state-of-the-art system, but unfortunately, nobody knew how to do anything other than the weekly test for it. Right. So have that emergency notification system, make sure people know how to use it, and make sure people know how to respond appropriately when they hear that evacuation. Yes.
Where do I go? And also make sure that your gate isn't locked if that's where they're supposed to go. The next one, provide adequate training. And by that, we mean HAZWOPER training for all workers who are expected to perform emergency response duties. In this case, the operator who donned the SCBA should have been HAZWOPER trained and was not. Ensure that all non-trained personnel understand that they are to heed evacuation orders and not attempt to provide emergency response for which they are not trained or equipped. Make sure that they know what they're supposed to do and make sure they know what they're not supposed to do.
Exactly. Yeah, it's sometimes a human nature that says, oh, well, I know what the problem is. I know how to fix it. Let me just go do that. Yep. And if you really don't have adequate protective gear and adequate training, you're just going to get yourself in problems and add to the incident in terms of fatalities and injuries, despite your best intentions.
Yep, it's right. I agree. It's especially people that if you know what the problem is and you know you can fix it, it's very hard to not do that. So totally agree. What's next?
Yep. The next one is that ensure that you have remote actuated emergency isolation valves at appropriate locations within your process. And if you're not sure where those might need to be, use that flowchart that's in the CCPS guideline or in the CSB report.
Absolutely. And I guess what? This is the last one. So the last one is, and this goes back to Molly, a point you made earlier, use the learning from previous incidents and near-miss investigations to prevent similar problems in the future. Ensure that these incidents are reviewed by the PHA team and incorporated into the PHA as appropriate. Also, use these CSB incident reports to make improvements without having to learn the hard way. You want to learn, certainly you want to learn from your mistakes. You also want to learn from other people's mistakes so that you don't have to go through them. And these CSB reports, that's one of the reasons why we take the time to put these podcasts together, because this is such a key thing for industry to make sure that we learn from, in many cases, the tragic incidents and mistakes that others have made, as this was tragic with the loss of one life. And whenever we do our incident investigations, we always should be thinking, how do we prevent from happening this particular instance, for example, for this particular strainer, Y strainer, but also, are there other places in our facility? Are there other places in our company where we have something similar that could happen? What do we do to make sure that it doesn't happen there? So use those learnings to prevent similar things.
Okay. Well, I think that wraps up this CSB report. If you have any comments about this week's episode or an idea for a future episode or questions about anything process safety related, we would love to hear from you. You can send us a voice message using a link in our episode description or send us an email at podcast@amplifyconsultants.com.
Yeah, we appreciate the excellent work that the CSB does in investigating these process safety incidents and then providing informative reports and often the videos of these incidents. And virtually everybody that I come in contact with when we're out doing our, doing our normal consulting work, virtually everybody has seen at least one CSB video. So people know about them. They do great work. We're doing our part to help ensure that these learnings are widely distributed so that others can avoid similar incidents. However, we always recommend that you go for further details on this report, this incident, as well as any others. Visit the CSB website at csb.gov and take a look at the reports and the videos and learn from the mistakes of others. And always ask yourself, could this happen at my facility? And if so, what do I need to do to make sure that we don't become another investigation for the CSB?
Exactly. Yes. Finally, our goal at Amplify Process Safety is to save lives by partnering with companies that handle highly hazardous chemicals to create world-class process safety systems. And it's our firm belief that these systems will help prevent catastrophic incidents like this one at Chemco. So please don't hesitate to reach out to us if we can help guide you on your process safety journey.
And with that, Molly, I would like to thank you for helping in this podcast. And listener, I would like to thank you for listening. And until next time, be safe out there.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Amplify Your Process Safety. Head to our website, amplifyconsultants.com, to find our show notes and other resources. Thank you for joining us in our mission to ultimately save lives by advancing process safety right here on Amplify Your Process Safety. Until next time.